It might be helpful to open up your PDF that Amy sent you. If we have problems with this, that's one option. Okay. Incredible. All right. Nobody move. Hope this works. So thanks very much for sticking around. My name is Jim Williams. I'm a clinical associate professor at Texas Tech. I work at Northwest Texas Health Science Center, but also I'm a clinical research director at Meredis, which is in Maryland. So it's a little bit of a commute. And also I'm a board member on EMF, which is the research arm of American College of Emergency Physicians. So if any of you have research ideas, I'd really implore you to go to the EMF website, Emergency Medical Foundation, and submit ideas, because we have a tremendous amount of opportunities there for research, particularly if you're someone who really hasn't done research, but you simply need a little bit of funding to support things. But we have a variety of things to do, so please keep that in mind for any of your academic interests. We'd love to support you in that. So what I'd like to talk to you today about is COVID-19 and thromboembolic disease, because I think, you know, among COVID, that this is one component that's clearly a big consideration. My disclosures, I am a consultant for AstraZeneca, initially Portola, Alexion, now AstraZeneca, but also Janssen Pharmaceuticals and Werfen, which is a developer for an assay for 10A. So I'd like to go through some of the objectives, and they're shown here. Basically, I want to give an update of the talk that I gave back in March in Park City about COVID storm and the cytokine storm in particular. And then we'll talk about the triggers for the inflammatory cascades and coagulation cascades. I'm not going to go through the cascades in much detail, but just show a little bit of what the interface of those is and why the patients who have COVID are such a high risk for not just venothromboembolic disease, but also for arterial disease as well. We'll go over the literature about prophylactic anticoagulation and COVID, what's out there right now, and then we'll discuss the PREVENT-HD trial. Just basically, it's an ongoing trial in which I'm involved. And I think that's going to be an interesting study about what it's going to give us some direction, basically, about how to treat some of these patients, particularly in an outpatient setting. So with that, let's get started. As an update, I talked to the group back in, what was it, March, in Park City. We talked about what are some of the options with treatment of these complicated patients with COVID. And particularly in that, we were looking at hospitalized patients. And, you know, again, at that point, when it was just coming out, the concern was everybody's getting intubated. What can we do to really minimize intubation? How do we really prevent pulmonary catastrophe in these patients? And one of the options, well, there were several options, looking at how do I blunt the coagulation, or sorry, the cytokine storms. And so the cytokine cascade has a lot of involvement and similarities with the coagulation cascades, because it's a matter of trying to find that sweet spot, right? Both do things that we want. You don't want it, you know, too revved up, but you don't want it too muted by any of your therapeutics. And so one of the interesting things was lenzulumab, which looked at patients who were hospitalized with COVID. So obviously they had an oxygen requirement, but we wanted to prevent something that extended and then put them forward in their inflammatory cascade to require intubation. And so basically what it was is a GM CSF neutralizing monoclonal antibody, which blunted things. And the cool thing about it was just high enough in the cascade where it really found that sweet spot. It was just enough to affect things downstream, which included minimizing the ramp up of the coagulation cascade, but not too much where it really created problems like CAR T things that some of the cancer patients had who may receive this. And so this was just recently approved for those patients who were hospitalized, who have oxygen requirements, who have comorbidities. It didn't exclude other treatments, so they are on REM, could be on steroids as well, and they may have even had monoclonal antibodies prior to their hospitalization, but it showed that it reduced the risk of mechanical ventilation. So that was a pretty cool thing, I think. More to come on that. So let's go to an update now. We'll transition to coagulation cascade and venothromboembolic disease and arterial embolic disease in patients with COVID. So what is it that COVID, you know, triggers between the inflammatory cascades and the coagulation cascades? Well, there have been several studies now, you know, 18, 20 months in the pandemic, that looked at some of the markers that we traditionally use. And a lot of it, you know, now I think we can say, okay, it's as expected. But again, where is the sweet spot? What do these markers show, and what's the number that is going to help me to pull the trigger before I'm go from maybe thromboprophylaxis or potentially to treatment? And so, you know, initially we thought, well, this is really similar to DIC because it's a ramped up coagulation cascade, but in fact it's very different. With DIC, the problem is bleeding very differently. In COVID patients, the problem is clot, too thick. So some of the things we look for with coagulation testing, when you look at PTPTT, it's prolonged platelet counts. They can be increased. The fibrinogens are increased. D-dimers, we know they're increased. Trying to find, you know, I think there's so many variables to find out what really is the number that's going to help me. That's ongoing too. But some of the things that we may not test certainly in our normal practice would be factor 8, von Willebrand factors, and some of the natural anticoagulants. We found perturbations in those. How many of you do TAG testing at your hospital for patients? Typically in the surgical realm, certainly with the LVAD, you're looking at those patients, right? So TAG is really interesting because it really shows the functional status of what the coagulation cascade is. And so when you look at the top of this slide and then extrapolate that to a functional part, you can sort of realize the things that are highlighted in yellow, yeah, it makes sense because it shows that we have increased a thrombin burst, we have an increased fibrin generation, we have, interestingly, greater clot strength, and then also we have reduced fibrinolysis, all of which supports the top part of the slide, which shows, yeah, in COVID patients, they form clots. So the incidence of thromboembolic events, we know, you know, they're fairly high. And so on the left, obviously, our COVID pneumonia. I'm not sure if this is going to play, but it's a CT scan of a PE. So scrolling down from top to bottom, you can see that fairly large PE, pretty good clot burden. And the guy in the middle, that's a doorway diagnosis. Yeah, he's got a DVT. Okay, so what is the real incidence, right? We know that there's a higher burden, but what's the number, really, that we're looking for? And this is a really interesting study. It looked at the risk of COVID and thromboembolic disease. It is high, and it's associated with a high-risk mortality, right? Because it's this domino effect. If they're bad enough where they have oxygen requirements to be in the hospital, and then they need steroids, and they have comorbidities, they're going to put them at a higher risk. So really, it's following the whole paradigm that we know about venothromboembolic and arterial embolic disease. So interestingly, in this looked at multiple studies, and it really gives us a handle about what is the risk factor of these patients. And it's helpful to talk to the patients when I get to the backside of the story of, you know, why should we thromboprophylax? Well, if it's a 1% event rate, right, it's really not so much. But when we look at this, the overall venous thromboembolic event rate was 21%, right? Not insignificant. And these were all comers. So these were high risk. These were also low risks. These were a very heterogeneous patient population. Looking at the DVT, of course, that was higher at 20%, and PE rate was 13%. And then arterial rate, that was not insignificant at 2%. So overall, what happens if they get this? If you looked at the pooled mortality rate with TE, was 23%. Right, so that CT scan that I just showed you with a fairly significant clot burden, that's a fairly significant mortality rate. And then with those without TE, 13%. So significant difference. And so we know that the pooled odds mortality, a relative risk increase of 74%. So far, so good? Okay. So let's talk about what's the interplay of cytokine storm, the inflammation and coagulation cascade. I think this is sort of interesting because now we have two things that are really ramped up, and we're trying to find that sweet spot, not just in each, but also where they intersect. And what this shows, it really supports it, the slide I showed you earlier, that it's really ramping up all of our clotting factors that we would test. Certainly there's a thrombin burst, but also it happens really early on. So it's almost as if this follows what my viral burden is. And I'll show you on another slide that early on we have a huge viral load and then it tapers off, but it's not coincident with that viral load, but it's just shifted a little bit to the left of the curve because that's when the consequences of that viral burst really affect the inflammatory cascades and it affects the coagulation cascade. Okay, so what's the current literature of prophylaxis of anticoagulation? Let me ask, how many people do you, if you have patients who are discharged from the emergency department, how many patients thromboprophylax? So you have a patient, any given risk factor you want to talk to. Okay, so Brian, what do you use typically? Okay. Adam, what do you use?
For prophylaxis.
Yeah, so we're not talking about treating. This is outpatient. They come in, they have COVID, they may have a comorbidity. Your choice, do you use anything at all?
No, we don't treat. And there's some studies that suggest that prophylaxis of outpatient doesn't help.
Right, and I'm going to show that. So, perfect, thanks. So that's a perfect tee up for this. So what it shows exactly in this is that prophylactic dose and anticoagulation. It's equally effective in higher doses of anticoagulation, reducing VTE risk, including patients in the ICU. Basically, this was a different section, hospitalized patients, right? It was saying, do we just thromboprophylax them, or if they're in the ICU because ostensibly they're at a higher risk, do I then give them full treatment dose? Okay, so this was in New England Journal, and it looked exactly at that, and it sort of stratified two groups. One was looking at the high critically ill patients and then the non-critically ill patients. So all these patients were hospitalized, and basically it looked at, do I get a benefit of increasing my dose to treatment dose in either of those two groups, and do I, you know, fall out of the sweet spot and cause bleeding? And so what they found is the therapeutic dose of, and this is looking at heparin in particular, obviously, because they're hospitalized patients, that the usual care of thromboprophylaxis had increased the probability of surviving to hospital discharge with fewer days of cardiovascular or respiratory support in patients with moderate COVID. So the moderate group is the one group, higher dose, the ICU patients who are at a higher risk, very different. So what about our patients, so the ones who we're not necessarily going to admit, but the ones we're going to discharge? Well, just like you said, that currently there's no role for aspirin in reducing mortality in progression to mechanical ventilation. And it's interesting because I think a lot of people are still hanging on to aspirin, looking at it as, well, I get the benefits of maybe a low-dose DOAC without the risk of bleeding, but in fact, that's not the case. Really, you get none of the benefits, but you do get the risks. Okay, and so this clearly supports that's not a good option. So I think, Adam, you may have been talking about this. This is one of the trials that has been published. This is an active 4B trial. And so what this did, it looked to the next step to say, okay, so let's see what happens with a low-dose 10A inhibitor specifically. And this was looking at apixaban. And so the question was, you know, they're symptomatic, clinically stable, but I'm going to treat them as an outpatient. Does adding antithrombotic therapy compared with placebo reduce cardiovascular events, cardiopulmonary events? And so not only did they look at a DOAC, but also they looked at aspirin specifically. And so their population, it was, you know, less than 1,000 patients. They had multiple sites. And again, it stratified it into four groups that you can see here. So the primary outcome was a composite of all comers. And so we know that there are some issues if you look primarily at a composite endpoint, because then you're really capturing a lot of patients and you don't find the nuances of who's going to benefit from my therapy. But the findings were basically that you don't get any benefit of any of these things, that you do get an increased risk of bleed without getting any improvement of their primary endpoint. And so it was for that reason that the current recommendations say, look, don't do it. So thromboprophylaxis, it does not improve outcomes in patients with COVID-19. And so it's interesting because then you have to say, okay, well, let's look at the patient populations, because I think that if you look at what their patient population was, were they high risk or were they low risk, right? And so we know when we're risk stratifying these patients, we want to look at the high risk patients specifically, because those are the ones who are going to really benefit from therapy, and we want to avoid treatment for those who are at low risk. And the interesting thing, when we go to this slide, it's, can you see that okay from how it's projecting? So if you look at the patient characteristics in these groups, they really don't have a high risk patient population. So only a third had obesity, or only a third had hypertension or diabetes, or smoking. And then they looked at some of the serum markers, and they looked at D-dimers. And so why I think this is interesting, because when you look at all the studies, am I going to, and this is even pre-COVID, you know, what's the patient population, and does that patient population extract to the patient who's sitting right in front of me, right? and then you're comparing like to like. And so I think the challenge was this, is that they artificially used a low-risk group with their presumption that they would get benefit and mitigate their risk. But it turns out that they didn't even get the benefit. So the interesting thing is, moving to the PREVENT-HD trial, is this is with rivaroxaban. And so this is an ongoing trial. They haven't published anything yet, but this also, it was a head-to-head trial. It did look at a composite endpoint, but we also have secondary endpoints that are broken out as well. And so you're looking at not just the VTE rate, but also arterial embolic rate, and of course, all-cause mortality. And this goes out to 35 days. So here's the trial, the overview. It is a head-to-head trial. We screen patients. We want to get them, obviously, as early as possible, knowing what their viral load is going to be early in their disease, and then what their subsequent cytokine storm cascade and what their coagulation cascade is going to be shortly after that. So we have an enrollment time, head-to-head. It's going to be Riva, which is relatively low dose at 10 milligrams, and we carry that out for 35 days. And it's against placebo. It doesn't prevent any other therapy that these patients may get. So they're outpatients, so typically they're not on oxygen. Because they're outpatient, not on oxygen, they're not going to be on steroids, but they could have gotten a monoclonal antibody at some point in their course. So the inclusion criteria, again, it's outpatient primarily. They have to have one additional risk factor. And so this is the key, I think. Our risk factors are maybe similar to what the earlier study showed, but when you look at what our patient population is of enrollment, they have more than just one risk factor. I think that's going to be the key. And so why is that important? Because when you and I are seeing patients who have COVID and we know that they're not bad enough to be admitted to the hospital, but they do need to go home, right? We look at those patients and say, okay, do you have the risk factors who may benefit from that, okay? So the interesting thing, again, this is all investigational. This is not on label in the setting of COVID. However, it is potentially on label for those patients in Riva who had been hospitalized and then discharged. Okay, so a little bit different, but it's in that same concept. Exclusion criteria, basically they excluded anybody that would have some factor that would significantly increase their risk of bleeds. And those would be things like a GI cancer, renal failure on dialysis. They wouldn't be a candidate for rivaroxaban anyway. They don't do well on any of the DOACs for that matter. Severe liver disease or a known bleeding diathesis. And then also we wanted to catch them in the early phase of their treatment. So if they came beyond 2 weeks, that would be really too far out, because also we know our event rate, specifically the venothrombotic event rate, occurs earlier during their disease course. So this is sort of too small to show, but basically it does have the composite outcomes primarily, and then we break things out into the secondary outcomes specifically, so we can tease that out more. Okay, so it's an ongoing trial. I can tell you a little bit about it. It was based on the Michelle trial, which was in Brazil, and it was presented at ESC, and I think it was back in August. And in that study, that was with Riva, similar study design as PREVENT-HD. They had about 320 patients, and it was really, I think, compelling because it did show that there was an increased survival rate of those patients, so looking at the composite endpoint, but it did not have an increased bleed risk. So that, I think, was really exciting because it sort of shows that maybe that 10 milligrams started earlier for 35 days is really the sweet spot to minimize events but also minimize risk of bleeding. So with PREVENT, we have almost 1,000 enrolled. Our event rates have been consistent with all the other studies for which the DOACs and specifically the 10A inhibitors have been FDA approved. And those are, early on, that's a time when your coagulation cascade is really ramped up, specifically when the cytokine storm of COVID infection is ramped up. So day 1 to 5, that's when the patients are high at risk. So as soon as you get that diagnosis after they're symptomatic, that's when you would potentially discuss the treatment options of thromboprophylaxis. Also, we found that the event rate, similar to what I showed you earlier, DVTs, much higher incidence than PEs, and there's a concordance potentially with outcomes of that. And the only adverse event thus far was just one major GI bleed, and so I think that's really compelling, too, with the safety. So I'm excited about the outcomes. It hasn't been broken yet. The code hasn't been broken, but those are just some tidbits about what to look forward to. So these are the current studies right now, where we are, and it talks about what are the CDC recommendations for thromboembolic prophylaxis in COVID-19 patients. Again, if you look at the outpatient setting, which is the group that we're going to be seeing, we want to look at risk stratification. If emergency medicine physicians do anything, it's risk stratification for anything. So we look at the patient's severity of disease, and the CDC grades it, of course, if they're asymptomatic, mild, moderate, severe, critical. So the group that would be looking for would be mild to moderate. They have typically COVID findings on their chest x-ray. They have COVID pneumonia, but they don't have an oxygen requirement, a supplemental oxygen requirement. Look at what their comorbidities are. That's really going to be key because that we know obesity is number one risk factor for putting somebody at a higher risk of VTE and all the subsequent things, diabetes, hypertension, and their ability to compensate for severe COVID infection. And certainly if they have a DVT or PE, is going to be dramatically less than somebody who doesn't. So inpatient, what I showed you from the New England Journal trial, standard dose thromboprophylaxis is what's recommended. It's not a treatment dose. That's a critical difference. Post-discharge, however, consider thromboprophylaxis, and that goes in line with what's already established with rivaroxaban. If somebody goes home, to treat them potentially out to 35 days. And I think that's really important when you look at patients who are getting discharged so early, right? We have borders in the emergency department. We have a really critical nurse shortage. We don't have the beds. Patients are getting out of the hospital perhaps earlier than what we otherwise might like. And so we know that when they go home, their risk of VTE and arterial embolic disease, it doesn't evaporate. It's still there. So if they're getting thromboprophylaxis while they're in the hospital, it makes sense surely in that short phase, right, particularly from day 1 to day 10 when they're highest risk, but you carry that out at a 10 milligram a day out to 35 days. So what about outpatients? We did show from several studies, particularly the ACTIVE trial, that aspirin, antiplatelets, there's no benefit. It only increases the rate of bleeds. And steroids, it's not so much for any of the venothromboembolic complications, but it's really only if they don't have oxygen complications or oxygen requirements. So what about anticoagulants? Currently, there's a 3A level of not recommending it, but that's based on what the published literature shows thus far. And from up to date, what they said is that if thromboprophylaxis is used as an outpatient, they would consider anticoagulant regime of Riva 10 milligrams a day for 31 to 39 days. And so I think that's sort of exciting stuff because I know personally I've seen a lot of patients coming in discharged, and it's a doorway diagnosis if they have a PE or a DVT. So if we can really find that sweet spot of, you know, not too thin, not too thick, minimizing their event rate, they're going to do a lot better. So the last slide sort of, it's a nice slide because it sort of shows the disease progression of that interplay of coagulation cascade and the cytokine storm and also what the viral load is, and then it shows also what the complications are that we're seeing. And so we want to try to find that sweet spot of, okay, here from the stage one early infection, we might not even see them up until day 5 of their symptoms when they're diagnosed. We want to get it before that cytokine storm explodes and really ramps things up. That's when we want to be aggressive and implement our treatment phase. So with that, I think we're pretty good on time. Let me take some questions if you have any, please. You got it. Okay. I'll be in the back if you have any questions. Thanks so much for attending, and enjoy the luau.